In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. In the kingdom of the paranoid, the one-eyed man is a spy. This is Paranoid Planet.
I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Esta nunca ha sido dictadura, señores. Esta es dicta blanda.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay.
I'm not gonna give you a question. You are fake news.
Silent breed is people!
Welcome to bonus episode 3.6C of the Paranoid Planet podcast. I am your host, Michel Jacques Gagné, recording this program from the Australian outback, where I am holed up in a cave trying to hide from a posse of outraged kangaroos.
That's the most foul, cruel, and bad-tempered rodent you ever set eyes on. It's a killer.
Get stuff.
He'll do you a treat, mate.
Oh, yeah? Manky Scots git.
I'm warning you.
What's he do? Nibble your bum?
He's got huge, sharp... He can leap about... Look at the bones!
Hi!
In episode 3.6A, I had a conversation with science writer Paul Jensen about some of our personal experiences growing up in the evangelical Christian culture, and some of the cult-like elements that sometimes creep up in their teachings and practices. There is also little doubt that evangelical Christians have been front and center, promoting certain conspiracy theories over the last few years, especially those that relate to QAnon, COVID-19 mandates and vaccines, stolen elections, critical race theory, wokeism, whatever that means, child abuse, public education, gender identity, climate change, and the like. And while many may assume that this is mostly an American phenomenon, it is actually pretty widespread everywhere, including in Canada and Australia. On the other hand, the major media don't give much attention to thinkers inside the evangelical fold who advocate for less paranoia and more sober second thought, more critical thinking, scientific inquiry, and respectful dialogue. Values that we here at Paranoid Planet hold dear. In 2022, I was asked by a friend, who is an editor at Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith, the Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation, to write a review of a short book, or a long discussion paper, depending on who you ask. It was titled, Who to Trust? Christian Belief in Conspiracy Theories. This book is a study of when, why, and how conspiracy theories gain traction among evangelical Christians, and what they and their leaders can do to guard against seductive misinformation. The book is the product of ISCAST, short for the Institute for the Study of Christianity in an Age of Science and Technology. It is a non-denominational Christian organization based in Melbourne, Australia, that promotes science education within the Christian community and dialogue between the church and the academic community. Before submitting my review, which, spoiler alert, was largely positive, I reached out to Nigel Chapman, the chief editor of the book, to ask him to take part in a recorded conversation that I would subsequently, eventually, air on my podcast. Nigel lives in Melbourne, Australia, where he works as a computer programmer. He has a Bachelor of Science degree and a Master's degree in Christian Theology. He is an author, blogger, evangelist, and a proponent of science education. This interview was recorded in December 2022. You will find links to a free online copy of Who to Trust, and also to my review of the book in the Reading Room section of our website, along with other links to ISCAST and to Nigel Chapman's writings.
Yeah.
Today I am speaking with Nigel Chapman, an Australian computer scientist and theologian, and the primary author of a short book titled Who to Trust? Christian Belief in Conspiracy Theories, which will be our primary focus today. I should also add that when I was Googling Nigel, I found a WikiFandom webpage that told me that Nigel Chapman is the main antagonist of a novel called Hickory Dickory Dock, which is an Agatha Christie mystery featuring Hercule Poirot. So I suspect that these are two different Nigel Chapmans, but just in case, I will watch my words carefully, just in case this Nigel is also a soulless serial killer. Nigel, welcome to Paranoid Planet.
You can't be too careful.
I can't be too... Luckily, there's several oceans in between us right now. So you're in Australia, and I'm over in Montreal. Whereabouts are you?
I'm in Melbourne, in Victoria.
Melbourne. And are you a fictional serial killer?
Not to my knowledge, although I believe they have complex mental states.
Oh, okay, that's good. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm a computer science graduate. I did a lot of... graphic design originally, did a master's in divinity, did some Baptist church planting in an inner city suburb in Sydney, recently got married and moved to Melbourne, and I do a bit of online writing, trying to solve a few interesting puzzles that are bugging me in Christian thought. Things like, conspiracy theories and same-sex marriage have been big recent issues. The main thing I've done in the last year or so has been the, what we're calling a book here, and which is generally called a discussion paper in other contexts, which is a project that was done with IsCast Australia, which is an organization of Christians who work in the sciences and other interested hangers-on.
Okay. And right now you're working mostly as a computer scientist, a theologian, or something else?
Well, computer scientist is probably too glorified a term. I am a computer programmer.
Okay. So give us a brief description of the book, or the discussion paper, whichever term you prefer, and maybe the process that you went through to create it.
IsCast has some periodic online seminars that they run, usually in sets that run in school terms. There was one that we were running last year, which had a talk on Christian involvement in conspiracy theories by Jonathan and Anna Clark, the other conveners of this discussion paper. It's variously called a discussion paper and a book because it ran to 160 pages in the end, which might make it the longest discussion paper in human history. The talk led to a bundle of people getting together and saying we should do something a bit more on this because we couldn't find good resources on it. There's not a lot out there on the academic and scientific literature on conspiracy theories and also how that can be made to apply to the particular problems which exist in Christian churches. At the same time, I was having a long, long discussion with an acquaintance who had gone way off into a number of the COVID conspiracies, among other things. And I took on the role of convening and editing that. We had about 20 people originally involved. There were about 12 or 13 who finished the project. Some of them were quite accomplished people. We had one or two professors of medicine, a few people with some theological training, quite a few retired scientists, which is more the IsCast demographic. That led to us splitting up into four groups and each taking on what seemed to be a sensible part of the topic, doing maybe 2 months reading and trying to summarize what we had found on it. The primary problem with that approach was that what we got back was very, very different material from the four groups. So there was then a much longer process of making it all fit together and giving it the same tone and approach throughout, and also filling in a bundle of the gaps that became apparent when we sort of looked at the flow of the material.
Could you identify the different parts of the book? It really has like five distinct chapters or so.
Yes. Well, we divided into four groups, and groups one, three, and four pretty much stayed on topic. Group two, we found we had If you remember the line from John Wick, we had given them an impossible task, something no one could have pulled off. So we ended up completely changing the second one. It was originally going to try and say what the real distribution of conspiracy theories was in Australian churches, and even broadening it to a global survey. There was just no way short of running our own study to try and find out what that is. At the same time, the material in part one had expanded to include a lot of political material, because the drivers of a lot of modern Christian conspiracism are now quite political. So that eventually became part two. So we have part one is about conspiracy theory, i.e. the study of conspiracy theories in academia. Part two is the political drivers which influence that in modern society, things like how polarization and populism both have given an enormous boost to conspiracy theories in churches. A third section, that's mainly thinking through the sort of Christian ethics that apply to conspiracism. And this was something on which we found a lot of stuff that just tangentially touched on the topic, but nothing that was in any way systematic. There's a tendency for Christians thinking about conspiracism to try and see if there's anything that the Bible directly says about it. And that, you know, they normally land on that one verse that mentions conspiracies in Isaiah 8:12. And but it's not very helpful, because it doesn't, the context doesn't translate to modern conspiracism. Part four is about how you can have conversations on the subject, and what sort of practical measures you can take in churches and in personal relationships to both prevent conspiracism from destroying those relationships, and also to inoculate against some of the problematic behaviors that often happen. And we also chucked in a little exercise on COVID conspiracies in the middle as a way to apply some of the ideas from parts one and two.
Who would you say were your major sources in terms of not necessarily the people you were working with, but the various experts or other thinkers that influenced the way that you went about doing this project?
There's a European organization that brings together a lot of conspiracy researchers, and bundle of those are represented in a particular paper called Understanding Conspiracy Theories, for whom the main author is Karen Douglas. And we found we couldn't really improve on that as an academic overview. There were maybe half a dozen other thinkers, Joseph Osinski, Jaron Harenbaum.
There was also a book, I think another paper or booklet that you had put online about how Christians should behave. I noticed that there were excerpts from that. And then I actually went and I found it. So was this project kind of an offshoot of this other book that you first wrote? It wasn't called How Christians Should Behave. How they should think?
Well, on my website, I do a bit of sort of public writing, trying to think things through. And one of the things that comes up is always some variation on the question, how should Christians think and speak? And in particular, should we be naturally resistant to polarization? That's one of the big questions that I've spent a bit of time on. So when we started on the ethics section, there was a whole bundle of stuff there that it was, you know, most convenient just to bring across into this particular paper. I was the leader of group three, which worked on the ethics.
I understand that you're a Christian theologian, so you have a particular audience, but do you think that Christians are more at risk of believing in conspiracy theories than secular people or people who have a different faith?
Well, I have an MDiv, but I wouldn't call myself a theologian, at least in any kind of professional sense. I'm not employed in that capacity. The connection with Christian Faith is partly because it was an ISCAST project, and it's an organization for people who are in some way on the boundaries of science and Christian faith. The question of whether Christians are more prone to conspiracism, that's kind of a yes and no. I like the research that I've seen, which I think was from Australia. It looked at a cohort that was one half religious and one half non-religious, and it found that there was a greater element of anti-intellectualism in the Christian cohort, but there was a greater element of anti-authoritarianism in the non-Christian cohort. And this meant that they kind of cancelled each other out. Although it raises the worrying possibility that if Christians become anti-authoritarian and that compounds the existing tendency toward anti-intellectualism, then that may go much, much, much further in a conspiracist direction.
Are there times when Christians are justified in being suspicious?
Yes. The something I'm quite concerned to emphasize throughout is that conspiracy theories do happen. Conspiracies do happen, but equally that theories about them often cause problems. And the overall approach of the paper might be summed up as saying that people who want to engage with conspiracy theorists need to recognize that conspiracy theories do happen, and suspicion of people in positions of power is very frequently warranted, and there are good historical examples of conspiracies that have been exposed. But at the same time, the ones that have been exposed have generally been, you know, crime and corruption of various sorts, and not the kind of global, what Barkin would call, super conspiracies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I met Barkin, by the way. I went to visit him in his home just this summer. A lovely man. He's an elderly man now. He's retired, but it was really nice to be able to chat about these things in person.
There's a book on religion and conspiracy theories, which the Brill Handbook of Religion and Conspiracy Theories. And that was really where we started. It was the best source that kind of combines the two topics. And everyone there relied upon his basic categorizations.
One of the subjects that we studied in our first season of the podcast was the similarities between conspiracy thinking and the thinking you often find in religious cults. Well, they're not necessarily religious. Some cults are not religious. Like, I don't know if you've heard of Nexium. That's one of the ones we mentioned. But, you know, there's often this kind of toxic religiosity and psychology you find in cults. Did you look at the similarities and differences between conspiracy thinking and cultish thinking? And would you say that they're either two branches of the same tree, or they're feeding off each other in some ways?
I think they're both manifestations of a very similar dynamic, although they take different forms in religious and non-religious movements. So if you have, say, sectarian or fundamentalist tendencies in a group, they're going to have the same kind of fringe mistrust of the mainstream, which tends to characterize conspiracist thinking. There needs to be a way to explain why the bulk of society does not agree with the insights of the special group. And that creates the same kind of dynamics. If I recently had to do a talk where I had to boil the whole thing down to just a few points, and one of the points that I think is a useful simplification that gets most things right is to think about conspiracism largely in terms of mistrust, as there are lots of other ways that people try to explain it, but focusing on it as a mistrust of outside or other groups, of experts and authorities, of anyone who specifically rejects or opposes the theory. This has the advantage that not only does it explain a lot of the behavior, but it also resonates with the way that conspiracy theorists themselves are thinking. They are consciously thinking in terms of mistrust. Whereas if you treat them as a bunch of deluded idiots, then you're not going to have much of a conversation. If you treat them as people who are mistrustful of particular institutions and ideas, then I think that creates a lot better common ground.
Yeah, I did notice in the paper, you speak a lot about dialogue, about people talking to each other, not necessarily to agree, but at least to understand one another. And sometimes that goes a long way to dissipate the fear that we have towards those that we think are antagonists or evil or just are plotting against us.
Yes, it's one of the fantastic things that Peter Boghossian says in his book, How to Have Impossible Conversations, that, you know, it's very rarely the case that people have just bad motives in a simple way. Most of the time, people see themselves as trying to do something good. And in order to be able to talk to them, you have to find a way to connect with that. In the case of Christian conspiracists, I think the point of connection is that they see themselves pursuing truth and justice. And probably in some cases where it gets a bit sectarian, they see themselves as pursuing Christian faithfulness, which they understand to be under threat in some way. And if you sort of come in and go, you are all stupid idiots, then they're going to go, no, you're the stupid idiot. And then there's going to be a long discussion of who's the stupid idiot. Whereas if you go, yeah, we agree on the need to expose injustice, the need to, you know, find out what the truth is about things that affect people's well-being. From there, I think you can move on to saying, here's my concern with conspiracism. Often it doesn't seem to be very good at exposing injustice or finding truth or persuading anyone about these particular claims. If it gets derailed into, say, making a lot of careless accusations, things it's not really concerned to verify, that is going to fairly reliably end up working against any objective of achieving justice. If you're not concerned whether the accusations you're making are correct, then you're going to fairly quickly veer off into slander. And that's going to work against both any kind of biblical ethic as well as the aims of achieving truth or justice. There are a few different areas that seem to have this same pattern. If you get drawn into conceit or into insincerity, into, you know, not apologizing if you find that you're wrong on something, if you get drawn into rage and insults, which seems to happen a fair bit, all those things are going to work against achieving those aims that really are the sympathetic aims that conspiracism has.
So it's important sometimes to be willing to lose a debate at the cost of keeping a friend or to maintain an open line of communication with someone with whom we strongly disagree.
I think that's true. But in the case of conspiracism, if you want to get to the point of talking about the issues, then you're going to need to come to the point of both agreeing to speak civilly and respectfully and to agree that you have a common ground in Christian ethics. Mm-hmm.
I found having a Christian upbringing myself, it's easy, I think, because we were talking about cultishness earlier. I don't think it's necessarily that one group is cultish and one isn't, is that in many different religious communities, you have people who veer towards the conspiratorial, looking for enemies of the faith, whereas others see the problem as human nature. So one church could be focusing on the power of sinfulness or selfishness and see that as the running theme in the Bible. Others might be looking, say, at the stories of Genesis and saying, why are all modern historians, anthropologists, denying these events? Therefore, there must be a cover-up, right? I was just listening to, not a Christian, but there's a kind of an armchair anthropologist called Graham Hancock. He just came out with a series on Netflix. And his belief is that there's an ancient civilization that was wiped out that basically had all this advanced technology. And I think it's easy for people who get a little obsessive with the origins of humanity, particularly if they come from a Christian or Jewish background, to look into that and say, aha, see, I knew it. There's something wrong with evolution. There's something wrong with history, with academia. There's a hidden past, and it goes along with our biblical beliefs, if you wish. And I also find that people sometimes look forward, they read the Revelation, and then they have a massive distrust, not in academics, but in government. Anyone who is in government, who passes a law that appears to be hostile to that religious community, is automatically seen as some kind of an antichrist figure, right? So the scriptures can lend themselves to a conspiracist reading, or they can actually be used to debunk conspiracist thinking, as I think you're trying to do.
Yes, there's a long history of exactly the kind of, well, of conspiracist thinking in the United States especially, and that I think is the fountainhead of it in the global church. The history of American eschatology, it by and large believes that there's going to be a great economic collapse, and that's going to be the thing that triggers the end times in the Derby type scheme. So that any kind of international monetary or economic organization is automatically suspicious for that reason. And that transferred really easily across to the WEF during the COVID pandemic.
Australia went through a pretty tough, not initially, but I guess there were a lot of lockdowns or a lot of safety health measures. And as coming from Quebec myself, the only part of North America where there were curfews and much stricter rules than in much of the United States and even most of Canada, how did you find that COVID affected Christians in particular in looking for conspiracist explanations?
Now, that is a multifaceted question. There was a lot of people who saw there to be an essentially eschatological agenda going on. So it was the forces of the world are rallying against the church. It's difficult to tell how widely that was the really the cause, because there's the dynamic where fringe groups are able to unite on a shared mistrust of the mainstream, and they are able to understand the problems of the mainstream in their own way, but still unite in opposing it. So you would see, I think this happened with the trucker convoys in Canada as well. There were strange alliances between groups where really all they had in common was that they mistrusted the government. You have far-right groups, you have the health and wellness people, you have Christians with a bit of a nationalist or sectarian bent. They're all able to come together because there's a mass of narratives about what the government is doing and why it's wrong, and they're able to pick and choose the parts of that which fit their individual stories. I think that was certainly evident here. I think that probably happened internationally to some degree. Am I answering that question?
Well, I think so. I'm just, because when I was reading the paper, It was interesting to find that chapter on COVID, but at the same time, it kind of felt like it got thrown in the middle. And I understand why, because it was kind of following up on how political discourse is affected by conspiracism, and then you were using that as a case study. But the book is more focused on the larger issue, and then you narrow down very specifically around COVID. And I also had an interest in this because I did a series of podcasts on how various people, but religious also, reacted to COVID. And I did, as you know, I did this, I sent you the link to an episode I did where I interviewed 6 or 7 people that I knew personally who had very divergent views on COVID, but they all claimed to be practicing Christians. So in a sense, I was asking you that question to then follow up by saying, did the very unscientific panel that I gather, did that represent the types of opinions you looked at by looking more deeply in how Christians react to this type of conspiracism?
I don't think it got the full spectrum, mainly because actually I was thinking as the first three were speaking that, oh no, he's going to get all people with PhDs for one side and then just have, you know, unqualified persons on the pro-conspiracy side. But then it turned out to be uniformly high across the board.
I think they all had university degrees. And the two extremes were both people with science PhDs who yes. worked in the healthcare background. So it was really interesting to see how these were total opposites. And yet, I would say that if you put them in a room and had them read, you know, some scripture, they would probably agree on 80% of it.
I would think so. My thought about the range is that there are a lot of people who won't actually talk, and they tend to be the ones who are just more straightforwardly suspicious, because it's probably analogous to the election polling in the US, where there was believed to be a bit of a bump attributable to people who, because they don't trust the government and don't trust the media, they're certainly not going to talk to, you know, people doing opinion polls over the phone. There's a tendency I've noticed for people to not want to say what their sources are, not want to face outside scrutiny because they are mistrustful of any kind of institution or authority that might provide that scrutiny. So I think it's genuinely difficult to get a large demographic represented in any study of conspiracism, just because the mistrust which drives the conspiracism also prevents participation in any kind of exercise of that sort. That was one of the things we found when we tried to get some sort of a scope on the breadth or the kinds of conspiracism that are represented in churches. I spoke to a few denominational leaders that I know, and you know, people I know do have problems with very conspiratorial ministers in their denominations, but it was not something that they generally wanted to talk about, at least not in the public sphere. I'm sure there are plenty of in-house discussions.
Have you personally had relationships or personal experiences that made you want to write this book even more? Like, I often will say on my podcast, and even to my students, I'll call myself a recovering conspiracist. I don't necessarily have a stronger knowledge than others, but having been through the experience of believing in certain stories that I then became convinced were false, it made me much more skeptical and cautious. And at the same time, I think less mean-spirited towards conspiracy believers, because I know I've been there, right? So it's, but if you've left the cult, you want to bring people out, but you don't want to just sit there and badger them. At least maybe some do, but I wouldn't be like that. So I was wondering, what life experiences did you have, you know, without betraying, you know, some of your closest friends, that made you more determined to, as I think the word you used was, inoculate people against conspiracism?
Well, I pick up the term inoculation because that's one of the things that is just universally agreed upon in the literature. It is easier to inoculate against conspiracism than it is to try and cure it, using the same medical analogy, after the event. Since, you know, if someone is super mistrustful, then they're going to be less inclined to listen, fundamentally. You know, in the main, a conspiracy theory, there's a chance of it being true. There is, and it's pretty much entirely dependent on the individual, whether it's going to cause problems in communities or families or relationships. And, you know, it's something can be wrong and have a whole bundle of problematic tendencies. But if the person who is pursuing it is someone who is making a real effort to not slander anyone, to not, you know, burn all their bridges, destroy all their relationships for the sake of it, then it's not going to be the kind of, it's not going to cause the kind of problems that make conspiracy theories so volatile in communities. We found plenty of examples of people talking about families or churches blowing up over particular claims. And in general, you could imagine the same claims being argued in a mature and cautious manner that would not have caused the same problems. So to a very large degree, I distinguish between conspiracy theories as a set of ideas and conspiracism as a kind of a movement or a tendency which has a bundle of characteristic behaviors that are just severely disruptive, both to individuals, their social networks, their mental well-being, to families, communities, churches, and also much more widely to prosociality, the tendency to do and act in the interests of others, to believe that society is in some way fair, to put trust in institutions and believe that democracy, journalism, science, all these things have self-refining qualities that tend to improve human life in the long term, even if there's all kinds of chaos in the short term. Now, I don't have any very close friends who've gone into conspiracism in a large way, though I do know plenty who are maybe in the high-risk category through being sectarian or fundamentalist in different ways. I define those terms as saying that sectarianism is when you are essentially isolating yourself from wider society, which is seen to be impure. Fundamentalism is when your stance toward wider society is fundamentally antagonistic. And that then continues into extremism, where there is a tendency toward violence in the conflict that exists. So there are many people I know who have some creationist or eschatological tendencies that I think, where there has been a big sudden lurch toward a form of conspiracism that becomes antagonistic and is willing to burn relationships. So generally, because they are acquaintances, you don't have the same very close relationship that I think is probably necessary to have a really good conversation. If the dynamic is happening primarily online, then there's a largely performative aspect to it. They are somewhat in the manic street preacher mode. They're not wanting to be saved from conspiracism. They're the people who are making the sacrifices, asking the hard questions, and doing what's needed to try and save others. So you've got to be able to calm things down and establish rapport. Well, like with cults, and this is the analogy that's sometimes used, a certain amount of the dynamic of cults works by splitting people off from their other connections and supports. And that, I think in that way, conspiracism can benefit from being antagonistic. If it's, I liken it a little bit to a pond with a whirlpool in the middle. If you're just sort of, you know, standing in the pond having a conversation, that's all normal. If you get sucked into the whirlpool, then everything's upside down, you're being buffeted from all sides, and the advantage that you might have from being reasonable, well-informed, well, for want of a better word, civilized in the way that you're going to conduct all your interactions, those advantages disappear. The advantage now is with the person familiar with being in a whirlpool. The sort of reflexive antagonism actually has benefits in that situation.
So you're saying they're comfortable, they're more comfortable with the chaos because that's where they draw a sense of familiarity as opposed to meeting you in the, to keep the same analogy, in calmer waters where people can just kind of sit and relax, listen, and not feel they have to reach a quick judgment on anything.
I don't think it's intentional. I think it's just that they're in a position of being very mistrustful toward a whole bundle of things that other people feel are very important, like public health, for example. So they're saying that the government public health departments are fundamentally corrupt or compromised in some important way. And other people are saying, no, this is how we're responding to this public emergency, and we need to actually, you know, not undermine these institutions. You know, there's a fundamental disagreement about who is trustworthy, and that becomes a fundamental disagreement about who is good. And that fairly quickly escalates into a conflict because one side will feel that the other is just gullibly falling in with lies that are being propagated by unscrupulous actors. The other side will feel that their opponents are really falling in with attempts to undermine vital public services during a crisis, you know, usually seen as happening for some kind of political advantage.
If we could narrow down much of what you say in this paper to one or a few basic lessons, how would you say, what are your top three takeaways, let's say?
Well, I would say point one, it's probably most instructive to think about the problem as a, at least where it is a problem, where it actually causes problems, as a clash between mainstream institutions and fringe ideas. That seems to be what produces most of the public displays of mistrust. There's going to be just complete disagreement about whether the ideas are problematic, but there's much less likely to be disagreement about whether the behavior is problematic. That lets you use, if you're discussing it among Christians, that lets you use a lot of, you know, Christian interpersonal ethics as common ground.
Is it because you think that behavior leads to danger, or is the behavior more likely to change the dynamic of how we relate to one another in society? Like the sticks and stones argument, right? If you hit somebody with a stick, obviously you're going to hurt them, but an opinion shouldn't be in a society where everybody is free to express their opinions should not be dangerous. Certainly that goes against a lot of what we hear these days from quote unquote woke, places where language becomes violence, but Do you distinguish then between those two things?
I think there's a tendency for conspiracist ideas to escalate into conflict. That is, the ideas have an inbuilt propensity for conflict. That's because they are fringe ideas are united by the experience of stigmatization by the mainstream, and they respond to that by mistrusting the mainstream. So there is definitely a tendency for conspiracist ideas to escalate into conflict. If we're talking about how far Christians may go in that direction, then they need to avoid, or at least be very careful with accusations and slander. They need to pretty much avoid strife and partiality, the tendency of becoming quarrelsome. They could benefit from some humility and sincerity that is not always apparent, and they need to be really cautious about reflexive judgments or rage or insults. And these are all the kinds of qualities that I think got me interesting, people who I would have thought would not be prone to those tendencies sort of move towards them through conspiracism.
And yet you think that Christians, I mean, it's part of their core beliefs. It's written in the scriptures to have that kind of attitude, you know, to love their enemies, this sort of thing. It's not like trying to convince them to be vegetarians, in which case there's no necessarily an agreed upon scriptural teaching. But certainly being respectful, you would think that that would be very central to the Christian beliefs.
Yes, but I think the reason that can fall by the wayside is that they see themselves being locked in a conflict in which not only they themselves are under threat, but there are innocent people under threat, and that they are the people who are bravely acting to save them.
It becomes like a crusade, right? It becomes like a holy war against evil, against some kind of imminent danger.
Yes, well, if you believe that the deaths of huge numbers of children have been suppressed by the medical fraternity, then if that's a thing that is true, then it's right to be angry about it. It's right to oppose it. So the having the conspiratorial ideas gives you enemies, and the fact that they're not people you know personally makes it much easier to see them as people who just have to be stopped by any means.
What conspiracy theory, if any, do you think is actually likely to be true? Do you have a favorite theory of your own?
There's definitely a lot of stuff that goes on in politics and the media that is, I think it tilts things in one direction or another. It's actually for this reason that I tend to, I try as much as possible to avoid simply supporting either the mainstream or the fringe, but trying to say what values help us to identify the good elements of either. So, for example, if you're saying, no, we mustn't trust the mainstream media, or you're saying, no, we mustn't trust those fringe crazies over there, invoking the MSM or stigmatizing people is almost completely the wrong approach. You need to say rather, these two groups are claiming to provide us with news. Which one of them is practicing journalism? Journalism has, certain objective standards. I mean, they only really came into being in about the 1920s, but they've been in place for about a century. So you can go, if they publish an accusation, do they find the person who is accused and get their response on the record? you know, if we've got two news sources and they are each claiming to be true, and one of them is mainstream and one of them is fringe, then it's not really important that one is mainstream and the one of them is fringe. The important thing is whether they are actually doing journalism. So if you want to know if they're doing journalism, then you apply, you know, any published journalistic standard to what they're doing. They, if they publish an accusation, then they give the accused person a right of reply. If they publish opinion, then they keep the opinion sharply distinguished from the news and they don't mix the two of them together. If they make a mistake, they publish a prominent correction. If you go to a news site and they don't have prominent corrections anywhere, then either they never make mistakes or they're not doing journalism. So you can apply standards like these to any kind of public institution or fringe alternative and see which is actually following the values.
Yeah. But you have to admit that some media, whether it's conspiratorial or not, do have an implicit bias, and they often will push it in various ways with full knowledge of the people who are on the editorial board. You know, Fox News might be a very good example, but, you know, there's a lot of journalists who mix their own viewpoint with news coverage, say, on CNN. And then if you get to fringier groups, whether it's Democracy Now! Or Breitbart, they clearly want to convert, not necessarily just inform, right? So there's got to be, if we don't use the word conspiracism, then what do we use for that?
Well, that's not conspiracism in itself, but you can't eliminate human bias. But the idea of all of these institutions of science, of journalism, of medicine, of public policy, all the rest, is that if we establish standards of objectivity, then we can use that to self-regulate against the bad tendencies of bias. And it's pretty easy to look for the people who are doing that and identify those as the people who are doing the actual journalism and ensure that you at least have a bundle of that in your media data.
Okay. I was hoping you'd just say the lizard people are real. That would have made it very quick and succinct.
They said not to mention that.
Last question. Well, actually, second to last question. Last known question. You're a Christian. It's coming close to Christmas time. Is Santa Claus part of an evil conspiracy to destroy the true meaning of Christmas? I have heard that in Sunday school a couple times when I was a kid.
Yes. What's the counter view? The only people who ever banned Christmas were the Puritans. I don't think it's intentional. I think it's people who are in the Joseph Kosinski diagnosis. They are losing social power and looking for people to blame for the loss of social power. The idea that there's a war on Christmas is really just another way of expressing dissatisfaction with the living in a kind of multicultural and pluralistic society, to my mind.
I was hoping you'd say Coca-Cola. the red and white Santa, and you know, same color as the bottle. A lot has been made about how modern Christmas is kind of a part of a Coca-Cola buy more sugar, ignore the cross sort of conspiracy.
Well, you should look up the Japanese artist Yoshio Itagaki. He has had an installation in 2005 where he depicted Santa Claus crucified on a cross in a shop window as a comment on the on Japan's adoption of commercialized Western holidays. I think the commercialization is probably a better candidate for an institutional attack on values.
Well, Nigel Chapman, I have one last question for you, if you're game. I don't know what it is. It's in this little jar over here. We call it the question jar. Are you willing to answer the question jar?
I am willing to hear the question.
Oh, okay. Well, let's listen to the question. If you don't answer the question, I was going to say I'll give you a dare, but that might not be appropriate. Depending on the dare, I guess. Oh, okay. This one's not too bad. Vegetarianism? Why? That's the question. For or against vegetarianism, and why?
I'm personally agnostic, but I do empathize in some degrees. I think it will become more popular over time as they get better meat substitutes, and as, well, possibly if climate change induces some food production crunches.
But do you remain a real Australian if you stop eating meat?
Well, most Australian marsupials are herbivorous.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you're a marsupial then.
We have very few large carnivores.
Okay. All right. Well, I'd like to end with a couple awards. The first is I give this award to many, to all of our interviewees, which is you are now an honorary member of the Ancient and Accepted Order of Speculative Haberdashery, which is our secret society. We also call them the Knitters. So they have the Masons, we have the Knitters. Your specific award is the St. Francis of Assisi Award for trying to get crusading Christians to chill out and love their mortal enemies a little bit more. So congratulations. I think that's a good award to have. I've had some more inane ones in the past.
Did Jesus get that one?
The St. Francis of Assisi Award? It might be the other way around. Maybe St. Francis got the Jesus Award at his best moments. I don't know. So thank you very much, Nigel Chapman, for being on our program. Thank you for letting us know more about your works and your concerns. And hopefully we can keep in touch.
Sounds good.
And that is the end of Bonus Episode 3.6C. It was brought to you by the letter N, a COVID conspiracy, a crocodile handbag, and a wallaby sandwich. If you would like to know more about IsCast, go to iscast.org. That's simple enough. And if you'd like to spend more time on the Paranoid Planet, why not visit our website at www.paranoidplanet.ca, where you can listen to past episodes, order a copy of my book, Thinking Critically About the Kennedy Assassination, read some of my other writings, send us your questions and comments, and, maybe, find out which conspiracy theories Jesus wants you to believe in. Join us soon as we officially bring Season 2 to a close with more conversations about paranoia, true crime, the Kennedy assassination, killer robots, and sharks.
With frickin' laser beams attached to their heads.
Until then, on behalf of Joan Lijo, this is Michel Gagné saying, don't forget to have your dingoes and wombats spayed and neutered. But don't do it yourself. It might not be worth the money you'll save.
Maybe the dingo ate your baby.
We'll see you next time.
Paranoid Planet, a podcast about conspiracies, paradigm shift, and critical thinking.